The integration of the village, as John Tram suggests, is oftentimes accomplished when we come up here. That is. We've taken some count of the population of the village, and we understand that when the village is at capacity, staff, guests, so forth, there are in excess of 400 people in here. And Zitaleli and I represent some people would say is about a Minnesota average of groups other than Norwegian or Swedish or German. Since there are 5-6 of us here, we consider things are about equal here in the village. This evening, we would like to give you an example of something that has taken place on at least one or two occasions at Bethlehem Lutheran Church. When Zitaleli and his family first arrived at our church, it could be called dialogue between an African-American and an African, or it could be called dialogue between an African and an Afro-American. We're not sure at what point either one began. We're not even careful to observe those kinds of rules anymore. However, there was a time when we did, and we'd like to begin with our story in relationship to each other, so as to let you later on join in the conversation. My first conscious experience with Africa began with my first Tarzan chapter movie. There was a place in Mobile, Alabama called the Lincoln Theater, and no pun intended, where we would go on Saturdays with 15 cents in order to find out all there was to know about Africa. So we knew more of Jane and Tarzan than we knew of those persons whom Jane and Tarzan seemed to have been engaged in some interminable encounters with. We always thought it strange that Tarzan knew all of the languages of the apes and the lions and the leopards and so forth, and those other persons whose skin was black did not seem to understand how to talk with the animals. We also thought it strange that a boy growing up in the jungle following a plane crash should become the person who was in total and complete control. But yet we accepted that information primarily because it was the only information available to us, and we grew up with some rather strange and, I guess, stereotypical understandings of what Africa was like. My first encounter with Africans outside of the movies began when a chap named Jonathan Akong, some people of Missouri Synod vintage would remember that name, came to visit our home in Alabama and presented us with a straw mat as a result of our having contributed Sunday school offerings for a mission work in Africa. The original mission expression of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod involving us was that we were to be a part of the church's mission to the heathen and the Negro. We were the Negro part of that expression, and the heathen were the Africans. Jonathan Acon did not act as if he were out of a Tarzan movie, and for that reason became a source of comfort and frustration to me. My second real encounter with Africans happened in the late 60s when I, with a group of African Americans, went to Africa for the first time. I've since returned to Africa on 4 or 5 other occasions. We were meeting in Addis Ababa with representatives of the Organization of African Unity. 9 African Americans meeting Africans for the first time without the benefit of any interpreters. The African General Secretary to the Organization for African Unity began our session with a story, and I'm going to share that story with you. He said that African Americans had developed views similar to Africans as a result of the non-contact between us. When we got off of the plane and we were greeted by representatives of the Organization for African Unity, there was a Time magazine person there who wondered who the Africans were. Because we got off the plane with ivory tusks and bones and dashikis and natural hairdos and all of those kinds of things, and we were met by 5 or 6 Africans who had on Brooks Brothers suits and shoes, and they had on ties, etc. And the Time magazine first said, who are the Africans here? We thought that the Africans were meeting the plane, but it appears as if the Africans are getting off of the plane. In our attempt to achieve the ultimate in loss of our American identity and our African identity, we had attempted to dress the part and were terribly confused. There are other kinds of things that I could share with you, but time would not permit. Zitalele still has to tell his story. The African who had to begin the session went to speak with his mother as to how he should deal with the African Americans, because this was his first experience with them. She tells the story to him, and he shares the story with us. A piece of driftwood, if it falls into the water, cannot become an alligator. It will be subjected to an awful lot of dry rot and wet rot, but it cannot become a warm or cold-blooded carnivorous creature. Therefore, those African Americans who are coming to visit with you, even though they have been in the water for a long time and they have been polluted, they have been changed somewhat, they are still very important and critical Africans whose home is America. Therefore, you treat them as they are and not as you were told they were or as you might wish them to be. That began the dialogue. With the emergence then of Alex Haley's Roots, and I'm sure all of you have seen the story, the film, or read the book, there began a new level of dialogue between Africans and African Americans. And African Americans are now pretty much sure of one unalterable truth, that our dialogue with Africans is indeed a dialogue with ourselves. But there are some differences. There are some strange and not so creative components of the dialogue. We may even explore some of those with you this evening. That, in essence, is at least my part of the story to begin this evening's discussion. And now we'll hear Ghitalele's story.
One of the things that has struck me in my wrestling with academia is what is called in theology theology as a life story. In other words, an experiential type of looking at the theological enterprise. Maybe many of you may wonder, why do I begin at that point? The reason is precisely this, that both Mavis and I are fourth generation Christians. What's the importance of that, you know? For one reason, it is important in the sense that not too many Africans have that kind of history behind them in terms of this new faith stance, Christianity. Whereas that is by right to be an occasion for celebration, it at the same time has a kind of what I call a lopsidedness to it, which arises from the fact that in order to be Christian in the African context, it also meant some kind of cultural deprivation, some kind of having to negate who you were, in essence. This never occurred to me as an issue up till I entered seminary. Because when I got there, I began to see that somehow, in my theological training, there was nothing African. The textbook, the language requirements were as rigorous as stringent as they are in any Lutheran seminary. Whereas I could cope with that kind of ambivalence when I went into the parish where I spent 4 years, it became even more pronounced. I'll share with you a little incident which showed really that I spent 7 years of theological training, 3 years of which were at the University of South Africa, and 4 years of which were in theology proper. After having spent those 7 years, I thought I really had everything that there was that a minister might need to move into an African parish situation. And this was a Terry Eben parish. When I got there, during the first year, I experienced one of the most severe culture shock factors that I have ever been exposed to in my life. A death occurred, and I visited the bereaved family and did all I knew how to help the family to cope with the trauma of death. And this family was not just, you know, a convert family of people that did not know what it was like to be Lutheran. I happened to be Lutheran. They had been schooled in the catechism, the book of confession, and everything else, and they knew that very well. In fact, could recite that better than I did. We went through the general burial thing as it is done in all Lutheran congregations. Then a week later, I visited the Deleuze family, only to find that there were two horns of a goat hanging on the inside of the door, no longer on the outside of the door. That kind of trauma, I knew what had happened. That at some time between my counseling and the resources of ministry that the Lutheran faith brought to these people had been taken care of, yet it did not suffice. Between that point of my second visit and the barrier, they had themselves moved to ask a diviner to come back into the home and to go over all the rituals that there is, which suffices to show continuity of life in the African context. Generally, pastors of my denomination would have reacted here simply by excommunicating this particular family, because that's the easiest route out. That's what the Rufus says, we should do. But I had sufficient training, both in psychology and otherwise, to realize that would have been a cop-out. So I skillfully threaded a thin line between tradition on the one hand and spiritual faith on the other. That instance helped to show me that all along, whilst I had celebrated being a fourth generation Christian, there was something that I had lost completely. So I began to investigate, what is it that is there in the African ethos, in the African milieu, to be appropriated, so that I saw the incense for me as the same incense that struck Luther when he realized that he no longer had to be Italian in order to be Christian, that it was a right to be a German in its entirety and still be Christian. Therefore, I used this traumatizing experience, which threw all my theological expertise and nullified it and changed it into something that I could appropriate for me as a challenge, that I needed some kind of reformation. So it was a moment of renaissance, a moment of a reawakening. From that point on, I have sought in my ministry or my theological endeavor to appropriate that ethos. And it has become now a moment of celebration for me and challenge. It has enabled me to see that if I am to be a whole person, I cannot deny my past, but rather I need to appropriate it in the here and now. And that, in essence, to me, is my own life story. I would like then to dialogue with you and sort of develop this into what kind of theology then emerges from that kind of meeting of two polarized situations. How does one appropriate that? My own contribution would be along those lines in the dialogue.
If you can sense what just happened, an African-American Lutheran in search of his roots elects to dialogue with an African, because that's where the African-American sees his genesis in this particular instance. The African, at the same time, attempts to move African Lutheran, move backwards in time, and one could say, I'll never catch you if you're going backwards. because when I get to where I thought I should be, you are going backwards. Okay. That's that in itself is it's been interesting for me. I didn't wear a daikiki tonight, and that's because I know better than to try to identify. That's one point. Mm-hmm. But just lately, let's exploit a little bit the other point at which there might be some divergence, but at the same time necessary for us to talk about so that we can make the kinds of connections that we're trying to make.
Mm-hmm.
Why don't you for me describe qualitatively the difference between the slave experience and the colonial experience? While my roots in this country are those of a slave, I suspect that my Lutheran roots are those of a colonized person, and that may require some unpacking. Your experience, both as an African in your quote natural state, and as a Lutheran, would be totally an experience of colonization. Is that correct?
Quite.
This issue first came up with us when some African American suggested that South Africans, in this particular instance, and it would be true of almost all of Africa, that they should approach the problem of civil rights and the strained and not so creative tensions between blacks and whites, utilizing those methods which black Americans used in this country, that is, the civil rights movement. The basic Gandhi principle of nonviolent resistance and the right to the redress of grievances in the streets, et cetera, et cetera. Would that be a point at which you would be able to talk about the difference between the slave experience and the colonial experience? Which one is worse? Which one is easier to contend with, in your opinion?
Sure. I think I'll take a lot on. In other words, I'll try to highlight the differences between the colonial experience on the one hand and the slave experience on the other, at your latter point of reference, namely the difference between the civil rights struggles in the United States and versus the civil rights struggles in South Africa in particular. I think for those who have felt, especially amongst our own black brothers here, for those who have accused us in South Africa of some kind of impotence, inactivity in our civil rights struggle, those who have done that have been misinformed on two levels. The first level is that, you know, they presuppose that the black civil rights struggle in South Africa was not as well coordinated or a concerted effort such as was their own civil rights in the 60s here under the leadership of Martin Luther King. I think that is ill-informed because it shows really, I mean, a misreading of history, which is unfortunate. Because many of the founders, for example, of the African National Congress had themselves studied here in the United States. And many of them had had contact somehow with such black personalities as Booker T. Washington and his writings. They had come into contact with people like W. Du Bois. And in fact, it does show in the writings, which is read, for example, Albert Luthuli's little book, Let My People Go, which is also has been published in this country and also available in most of the public libraries in the United States. You'll find that some of the strategy that Albert Luthuli was using, who received the Nobel Peace Prize in 1960 for his activities in the civil rights struggle, shows that, you know, he had been exposed to some of the dynamism that Martin Luther King, for example, had. And he had the Nobel Peace Prize prior to Martin Luther King. So that the fact that, you know, the civil rights struggle in South Africa has been somehow less vigorous less aggressive as that amongst that subscriber and peers is for me an unfortunate thing, which seems, at least at this point, to arise out of misinformation, or perhaps is, to be more pointed than that, is a revision of the same kinds of analysis and dehumanization that colonialism as a factor, even for Black Americans, may be responsible for. In other words, we assume that Western standards are superior to anything else, period. So you don't even check your information to see if at all those people are as sophisticated in their thinking processes and planning processes as perhaps you, or in certain instances might be even better. That's one level. Then I want to address the second level of the differences between the slave institution on the one hand and colonialism on the other. And I'd like here to keep the same, really, because the two are incompatible. When it comes to political aspirations, I think my affinity and point of identification with the American experience would be analogous to the situation that the Native Americans face in the United States. The Native Americans has been pushed into reservations and has no political rights within Greater America today. Absolutely no rights. The interesting instance, for example, is that when in the American reservation people have discovered synthetic fuel, even those lands that have been ceded by right to the Indians, there are endeavors now to take them back, including force. That is in such a predicament of the Black South African. He has been pushed at the point of a baroness to the very fringes of the geographical area of the Republic of South Africa, and can in fact be, his land is in the little 7% landscape that he supposedly should own by the 1936 Land Act of South Africa. If they should discover, for example, in KwaZulu, where I'm supposed to be a Zulu, there's a lot of anthracite, that is a high form of coal, with less carbon. When the government wants to create a mining consortium in that area, it's supposedly to be under KwaZulu, they simply will move in there and just take it to and use it with no qualm, because the people there have absolutely no power. It is at that level where I think the slave experience as a human rights problem is less severe than the kind of overt and ulterior motives that support a colonial government, especially if that colonialism tips the scales and moves to what I call, what the political scientists call, imperialism. In terms of that, our lot as human beings is more, I mean, we have been more dehumanized. I know that according to South African, South African officials may even go to the extent of saying that, and they said this all the time, that Black Africans in South Africa have a higher living standard than the Africans in the rest of the continent. And this argument arises from the fact that we should be contented with our lot merely because of the calm. In other words, the mentality here is that half a loaf is better than no bread. And to come to theology is the life force ethic that is operative at that instant. Now that they can give us the calm, then we should be contented. What could be more dehumanizing than that kind of system? We are worse than slaves, even though there is nothing in the South African law that calls us slaves. So that at that point, we are in a predicament that is even worse than the Black experience. I say that because The reason that the civil rights struggle in this country succeeded is that in the Constitution of America, built in into that Constitution, were certain basic rights for every American. So that they could utilize them, that platform, and appeal, and they could really build up a concerted effort to bring about and appeal to. They have appeal processes that have never been attainable for Black South Africa. And for that reason then, our struggle has been more complicated. Because we just have no right. Absolutely no right. There's nothing in the South African Constitution that we could appeal to as a point of reference to begin to re-emerge and assert ourselves from that viewpoint. And that, to me, in essence, is the difference between the slave institution as it was operated in the United States and the imperial and colonial experience as it operates today in the Republic of South Africa.
Well, I suppose that we could stop now and just have the rest of the circle join us. But there are questions which I'm sure we would not be to, but the two things which we've addressed may be providing some room for discussion. If not, then you may talk with us about anything you'd like to talk to us about. That's just kind of the way we understand ourselves this evening. Let me conclude our talk just lately by saying that there are several ways of knowing. The way that you and I have discovered of knowing each other, I think, are most creative and most productive, at least for me. And I hope that our experience here at the village will be instructive to those whom we will let into our story. So we're simply let me into our story.
Yes.
We experience you had with the couple at Kesh. The ceremony that they had performed, was this a native burial ritual, or was it some sort of pre-burial ritual?
It's precisely what the Zulus call in their ritual, the ritual of ukubuyisa, and that's the Zulu word for it. And it translates as, you know, the bringing into life of the deceased person. Africans understand spiritual reality, or at least their form of enacting what we within the Christian faith call resurrection in some kind of an extension of life. So that whereas death is traumatic and must be break, but they have a notion of some kind. I don't like to use the term reincarnation, because a lot of anthropologists in particular, and sociologists of religions as well as historians of religion, have tended to interpret the Ugubuyisa ceremony to be some kind of reincarnation, some kind of reenactment of life in terms that are less than a Christian. So at best it be syncretistic to do that kind of ritual, and therefore be dismissed because of the notion of the contact of Westerners, especially Western intellectuals, with the Indian and particularly Buddhist reincarnation literature, which is essentially in the theosophic society, even in the Bay Area, is reenacting itself in some of the so-called new religious consciousness. Some people are beginning now to even not to be as opposed to notions of reincarnation, even at that level, negative level, as I would. So I try to avoid those kinds of terminologies and see it for me as a kind of reenacting and affirming life after death, the best you know how. And it seems to me to be something that the Christian, for example, we could really put into our liturgy and use to begin to appropriate as an affirmation of life after death, and not try to reinterpret it in terms of what we thought would be in terms of syncretism. Because I don't think, because the Zulus have no notion about Buddhist nirvana at all. They never used the term. But they knew that there was something like life after death. And in the Christian experience, because they were told that was pagan, heathen, that was something that was taboo. If you were a Christian, then you did not have to do that. So that I don't think it's a literalistic understanding of, say, by performing this ritual, using this goat as, you know, as a symbol of that, as the myth that informs that ritual. That I understand that in its deeper sense as symbolism, as we understand symbols to be. And in particular for me, as Paul Ritter, for example, speaks about the depth of symbolism as a force. So that I'd like to see that more as a progressive and a most positive way of affirming resurrection or some kind of promise of life after death. And it's what I call in theology, in my own theologizing experience, what I call, rather than realized eschatology, it represents for me what I call realizable eschatology.
Have you been able to work this in with your theological knowing that Jesus Christ is the Savior and that life after death comes through Jesus Christ, the belief?
I do.
I mean, have you been able to look at him with your people? I mean, I think that's wonderful. I think that's really beautiful to keep your culture.
Yes, I try to do that all the time.
I think we try to change too many cultures, and in doing so, we ruin what we're even starting to try. You can't convince people that they're wrong when they've been living that way for thousands of years. And I think it's what we should do is try and instill in them that Jesus Christ is the Savior and work it into their culture rather than trying to change it.
Well, yeah, that's always the issue of ripping something out without having something sufficient to put into its place is an issue that's at stake here. And that has to do with later on this week I'll be asking the question, what color is your Jesus? And then I'll tell you what color mine is. I'll even tell you what language he speaks and how he behaves under certain kinds of conditions. And I suspect that the Christ who is not brought into, but the Christ who is revealed, where the Christ is already, is a different kind of same Christ, a different kind of understanding of his operating principles. One of the problems with missionary incursion is that it presumed that it was taking Jesus. And I guess the Jesus that was taken was basically a long-haired, blue-eyed figure who generally deserted on the fire. The task is of revealing Christ where Christ is becomes a much more complicated one, and it's an issue that's teachable, we believe. I told Zitalele that one of my primary tasks during my formative years, the years in when I first decided to become a Lutheran pastor, was to train missionaries to go to Africa to do precisely what was done for the most part, and that is to rip something out with nothing really sufficient to go into place. Now, that does not suggest that Christianity in Africa is to be credited only with
with an African tripping over to Christ. And there's some good things to be said about at least one or two of the missionary experiences. Mm-hmm. A question now, Paul.
As you mentioned before, they're trying to catch up with him now. We're possibly trying to catch up with other efforts. And in looking at that, and looking at modern attempts toward church unity, it almost seems that maybe it's time to advocate church diversity as a way of approaching Afro-American African issues, black African issues, white for black, any of the issues. The only way it seems that we're going to understand the revealed Christ on a world level is in advocating diversity rather than unity. Or diversity in unity.
That's the point is diversity within unity. One does not have to, I guess most Americans come out of the old melting pot theory. And it's like sending all Americans to Detroit and running them through the assembly line, and each one comes out with Ford stamped on his or her buttocks. We don't see America that way. We rather... America, the United States of America, is not a melting pot. You melt people and you've destroyed them. It's rather a stew of indigestible lumps, which then makes it tasty. So we're not talking about any kind of lockstep unity, even within the quote religious enterprise or Lutheran enterprise. We're talking about diversity, where I can be me and you can be you, and we find dialogue, find reasons to dialogue about that, and we both benefit from it. I cannot become an African in the sense that Dittalele is an African. I know that now. He can't become an Afro-American in the sense that I'm an Afro-American. But it's our unity in our diverseness that makes us both teachable. We expect, well, you made some reference, I believe, to Lutheran unity. That's one that we're looking at. We'd like to color that process a little bit. And at the same time, while we're coloring it, assure that there are certain kinds of things that are retained now, which we may have learned both from the colonial experience and from the experience of segregation in this country. It wasn't all bad. We were debating once whether or not Dr. King's failure to integrate totally the American society may not have been a blessing in disguise. He may have succeeded in integrating us into something that was rather sick and insane. So our being apart from it may have been our salvation, and it may have been a part of the salvific experiences that we can now bring to it once it starts up again.
Once what?
The whole process of human intercourse. There are several views of history I shared with. There's the Bancroftian view. Most Americans still have that view of history. Kind of like God is, you know, moving us along the straight line and moved us from Plymouth Rock to what is now called American Samoa. Then I suppose there's the Marxian view of history that things run, you know, like so. And then there's the ghetto view of history. So what goes around comes around, and it is coming around again. In other words, we are suggesting the South African situation for me presents in living color the fact that we are a long way from having solved the problems of initiating dialogue, primarily because it's been one-way conversation. For when whites say, integration, they meant one thing, and it really meant the erasing of the culture of our people. Zitlali's experience with becoming Lutheran was very similar to mine. In fact, our stories are almost identical at this point. And I did not bother to make those kinds of statements because I thought that they were self-evident.
It seems to me, if I may add my little bit here, that all of us are, as human people or persons, represent two poles of life within the context of the human condition. Each one of us has those polarities. There is one, on the one hand, what I call my particularity, who I am. And that is even different from who my dear and lovely wife Mavis is. There is an element of diversity even at that level. Her own particularity as a person and my own. All of us have that. And that's where diversity for me, or pluralism, manifests itself, even in the most micro level of existence for all of us. Where the interdependence manifests itself is that none of us can make it alone. I do not think Jesus died for me alone at all. I believe Jesus died for all of us, me included. And it is at that level of interdependence that I think our differences tend to complement each other. That may be interpreted some kind of a macrocosm within a macro now rather than microcosm, being operative and present in each of us in the human condition, in the larger understanding of what it is to be a human person or to be people in this world. And that's where all of us have a contribution to make to each one of us, without denying who we are or being bashful about who we are, but rather complementing each other. Of course, there are points of friction there, and that's where diversity probably is problematic. But I think there are positive things about that in terms of what we describe in sociology. I'm a sociologist by training in what the sociologists call pluralism, positive pluralism. That would be my answer to your question, that you, as you are my brother, and I am your brother's keeper in as much as you are my brother's keeper at that level.
That a lot of times, I think a lot of people focus on with Christianity is the fact that you have to know Jesus to get to heaven, sort of thing, or have to be through this. I don't know how that experience turned into your theology or not, but it interests me that we really don't know about these other peoples in their religion. So many times you hear that they have things that are so similar. They may not just be exactly like our theology, but like a concept of life after death or some of these things. Maybe you can't answer this, but I guess I know that sometimes bothers me that there's people who maybe have never been exposed to Jesus in parts of the world and they're not going to get to heaven, but maybe they have other methods of receiving these things that we're just not aware of on our Western way.
Yeah, I understand what you're saying. I once at the University of Bangalore, I was dialoguing with a Hindu philosopher, and I was there to talk about what Jesus means to me, and I was not apologetic about that at all. I was just there to talk about what my faith means. And to speak as a Christian, non-apologetically. And about two-thirds of the way through the dialogue, he raised a copy of the Indian Express, and it had the face of a black girl on it. And in the back, there was a burning cross.
and it was a picture from Little Rock, Arkansas, someplace near Little Rock. And he said, how can you come over here and talk to us about Christianity? Talk about converting us to Christianity when they use the symbol of your faith in the United States to terrorize you. Well, my response to that was, I really didn't come for the purpose of conversion. I really didn't. And I was honest about that. And I said, in fact, I'm going to say a prayer now that you would be and remain a good Hindu. Well, we stayed up all night after that. And he said that I nearly caused him to become a Christian. That's all I'm going to say about that. I'm just not prepared to try and exploit either the good sense or the bad sense, the way in which God chooses to reveal herself.
Chris, may I ask you, you made the point that there are no constitutional guarantees for the black people of South Africa. Does that mean that you would have no access to the court to agree to that? I mean, could you carry a civil case into the courts?
That's a kind of complicated question to answer in the immediate. By right, I think if I were a white South African here present, I would say there are some guarantees. And then quote, for example, if I were really representative of the South African government and say, well, we spend so much money for legal advice and we'd let the prosecutor and in fact even go and say in liberal Natal, quote unquote, because we have our own, we have those kinds of things too, operative in us, you know. The Cape, for example, is regarded as much more liberal, and Natal is more liberal than, say, for example, the Orange Free State, where today, I mean, blacks must be out of town at 9 p.m. every night. If you're a black person walking the streets of Bloemfontein at 9 o'clock, you either be whipped thoroughly by the police, or you are arrested for 24 hours, then that's how bad it is in the Free State. At that level, for example, which is always what I prefer because it exposes the system for what it is, rather than my own back in a child where there's what I call quote unquote quasi amicability. But the reason I say that there are no constitutional guarantees for me as a black person arises from the fact that I have no legal rights in South Africa, no human rights at all. I'm represented in parliament by a white person that is appointed by a white parliament and just simply represents me. I have no way to vote for that person nor to oppose him in any sense. If I did, in fact, I'm liable for prosecution under the Suppression of Communism Act, which has since been extended into the Terrorism Act, which made some weird things where I can be arrested for 180 days without, detention, okay, detained for 180 days without any appeal at all. And if then somehow the churches come together and then I'm brought to a trial of some sort, I could serve a minimum of 5 years. So for those reasons, we absolutely have no constitutional guarantee. Everything else that comes really is given to us out of, quote unquote, the white man's goodwill. And at that point, the system itself has no goodwill for me.
Excuse me, no, with the statement of no goodwill, we'll stop. I think it's time for church, isn't it? Okay, so we'll end our discussion with questions. Thank you for being with us.